Thank you very much for joining us today. I have a real treat for you today. Our country is really dealing with a lot of issues on the political, cultural, social levels in terms of just our relationships with one another and how we relate to each other's communities. And many times, or we do know that many of these challenges have resulted in some of the things that are going on in our political lives nowadays.
Welcome to the Empowerment Zone with Ramona Houston, where we zone in on Black and Brown relations and our journey to empowering our communities.
And so today, we're going to talk about the Neo-Confederacy and white nationalism in Atlanta. And we have for our guest today, Jeffrey O.G. Ogbar. Excuse me, Dr. Jeffrey O.G. Ogbar. Dr. Jeffrey O.G. Ogbar is a professor of history and the founding director of the Center for the Study of Popular Music. He is the author or editor of several books, including Black Power, Radical Politics and African-American Identity, Hip Hop Revolution, The Culture and Politics of Rap, and The Harlem Renaissance Revisited: Politics, Arts, and Letters. In 2018, he released Keywords for African American Studies with co-editors Erica R. Edwards and Roderick A. Ferguson. Dr. Ogbar's articles appear in the Journal of Religious Thought, Journal of Black Studies, Soul Central, and Radical Society, among other publications. He has been invited to write for the New York Times, Room for Debate, and the Daily Beast, among other publications. Raised in Los Angeles and born in Chicago, Dr. Ogbar received his BA in history from Morehouse College and his MA and PhD degrees in history from Indiana University. And now he lives in Hartford, Connecticut. Welcome, Dr. Ogbar.
Hey, welcome. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
I'm excited about having Dr. Ogbar. We are classmates at the Morehouse College. Our professor was Dr. Marcellus Barksdale. We were
in his Dr. Barksdale.
Yes, we love Dr. Barksdale, and he was one of our I know for me, I'm sure for you, one of our most influential professors in undergrad. He really made an impact on my life, and I'm sure he did yours as well. In fact, in that class of maybe 25 student scholars, I think seven of us came out with PhDs out of that one class.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And, you know, a lot of us were back to meet him at his the celebration for his retirement at Morehouse. And, you know, it was a pleasure seeing you there, seeing other people there. And, you know, I think that there are a few people. I had some very good professors, but I think the single best teacher I ever had in college was Dr. Barksdale. And his that class, African American History, became a sort of model for how I like to teach a class. It's a goal that I've yet met, but I always struggle to meet it. And it's a standard. I'm in it for 20-some years now. I still can't reach it, but I struggle for it. Though. I try.
Well, that's interesting to hear you say that, because it's the same for me. He is like my favorite professor in the classroom. I mean, he had personality, you know, the way he taught the class, the way he engaged us, the way he attempted to bring out the best in each of us. I just thought he was incredible in the classroom.
Exactly. Yeah, just a phenomenal professor. And so he, I'm glad to see that people have come out to celebrate him and give him his flowers, you know, the way they do.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, Dr. Ogbar. We always on the Empowerment Zone, we like to know who our guests are because we come from such a wide range of experiences. Can you tell us a little bit about your personal and professional background so our audience can get to know you?
So as you mentioned, I was born in Chicago, raised in Los Angeles, and I am, as I mentioned before we kind of started, I have my LA Dodger cufflinks on, so I'm a Dodger fan. I follow Dodgers, world champions, and so we hope that they can repeat this season. But It's hard to follow baseball out here in Connecticut when you're trying to follow the LA Dodgers. So that's a challenge, but no doubt. So after LA, after I graduated high school, I went to Morehouse, as you noted. And when I started college, I wanted to be, I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. I was a first generation college student. My mother actually was putting herself through community college when I was growing up out of Los Angeles, and she was, you know, transferring to different schools. And so right before I graduated high school, she graduated from Cal State Dominguez Hills out in LA, Southern California. And but as a first gen college student, I knew no one personally who had, let alone a college degree, but even like my mother's social network, no one mm-hmm. came to our apartment who even, you know, had a college degree, let alone an advanced degree. So thinking about anything beyond a college degree, you know, was not something that I didn't quite know. I know I was intellectually curious. I read a lot, but there's a lot of stuff I just didn't know about my professional possibilities. So when I started, I just was like, well, sociology helps explain a lot of my curiosity about power relationships in society. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about anti-apartheid activities as they were going on in the 1980s. And then I thought about law school, and I was like, hey, I want to go to law school. There's this show called LA Law, and Blair Underwood played this character, Jonathan, who's a super cool young attorney. I was like, I want to be like that dude. And Morehouse had this pipeline going to Harvard Law, and the character was a Harvard Law grad. So I was like, I could go to Harvard Law. I could be like Jonathan from LA Law. I could go back home and do all kind of great things. And so I was thinking about law school, but then I became a Ford Foundation Morehouse Scholar. And that program was designed to encourage students to get PhDs. And Dr. Barksdale happened to be the director of the program. And I knew people who were going to law school who were accepted in this Ford Foundation program, but they still knew that it would look good on their CV and they would go to law school. So that was still my intention. But in that program, I thoroughly enjoyed the research. I was paired with Dr. Giles Conwell, mm-hmm. who was my mentor in that particular research project on the two most significant African-American Catholic churches in Atlanta. That was it. I enjoyed the research. I enjoyed sharing it. And the PhD was something I wanted to pursue. So that was pretty much the beginning of my junior year. I decided to do graduate school and get a PhD. And that was it. And I never looked back. And I just kept up. And then went to Indiana, and my first job out of graduate school was University of Connecticut, and I've been here since. I've become a New Englander to some extent, where I don't have this accent or anything, but I do enjoy mild temperatures. So it's like 90 some degrees. I start complaining. This is wild. I like the heat back in the day, but now I'm kind of intolerant of a lot of heat. So.
Yeah. So tell us, you know, in your work, you decided to be a historian. So why did you choose to study the Black Panthers and as well as hip hop music culture, African-American music and culture? And then we'll get on into your topic. I'm very curious.
So in undergrad, I was politicized and I gravitated to Black nationalism. And then in the process, I was critiquing, as someone who was a history major, I was looking at my own political involvement in historical context and thinking about generations prior and the generation right before ours during the Black Power movement. I was fascinated by radical revolutionary mm-hmm. politics, and mm-hmm. the Black Panther Party, more than any organization, piqued my interest. And I remember reading about Fred Hampton in particular. And then, you know, he's from Chicago, and mm-hmm. my mm-hmm. parents, of course, were in Chicago. They remember Fred Hampton's murder. And I remember I had an uncle who was real wild, but my uncle, there's a story that my uncle was in the Panther Party. He didn't ever express revolutionary politics or anything, but he apparently had some affiliation with the Panthers, and there were a lot of sort of people that were like my uncle who came to the party and, you know, were revolutionized, but others who weren't. And there's a long, complicated history about that. And the Panthers talked about that at the time, like mm-hmm. pulling what they considered brothers off the block, mm-hmm. getting people who were what Huey Newton, Bobby Seale, and Eldridge Cleaver called the lumpen proletariat, those mm-hmm. elements of society that were in the fringes of the formal machinations mm-hmm. of capitalism. Mm-hmm. They could be pimps, drug dealers, gang members. These sorts of folks were not formally invested in the system of capitalism, but therefore they were sort of open to its destruction. They were not invested in the same way. Mm-hmm. So if you could take a gang member and make him politicized, right? And that person who might already be armed, might already be fearless to some extent, that person's, you know, zeal and fervor in the proper political context could be directed towards his liberation rather than the destruction, of people mm-hmm. who were already poor in those communities, who were mm-hmm. victims of this order, this capitalist order. So the so in some ways, my uncle kind of fit into this lumpen proletariat mold, but there were all these other reasons beyond my uncle that I found the Panther Party fascinating and interesting. So in graduate school, I began doing work on the Panthers. It broadened to look at Black nationalism going back to the 19th century. And then eventually it became just the Nation of Islam and the Panther Party, and looking at popular reactions and the extent to which those two organizations helped shape a historical moment, a 20-year period, mm-hmm. a sort of generation. Mm-hmm. And then that became the core of my book. My book was broader than that. It ended up looking at the Black Power movement and still looking at how the Panthers and the Nation of Islam really shaped in indelible ways the Black Power movement.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So let's go into from Black Power to white nationalism. So I'm really curious about your new book project. That's what we're here to talk about. And what you are finding, and how this information fits into our current moment, because as I stated earlier, we have some serious issues going on in the country because of white nationalism, and it's really being destructive toward our communities and culture.
Yeah, so you know, it's interesting that Black nationalism itself is an outgrowth of, you know, being confronted with white nationalism. And it's not two sides of the same coin, mm-hmm. because, you know, Black nationalists are trying to escape oppression, right?
They're right, exactly.
They're trying to live.
I'm glad you clarified that, because I don't, even though I said it that way, I don't by any means equate Black nationalism with white nationalism. So I'm glad you caught that error in the statement, because that could be perceived as that. Thank you.
Yeah, I didn't even take it that way, but just as a clarity. Mm-hmm.
Point, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That, you know, the reason people gravitate to Black nationalism in the 19th century is because.
And now
is mm-hmm. that they were not allowed to vote. They were mm-hmm. not allowed to become police. They were not allowed to become school teachers, not allowed to go to hospitals, not allowed to get employment, not allowed to join the military. So for all these reasons, they were like, if we are completely isolated from this political body politic, then we need to create our own body politic, right? And if we cannot, you know, get freedom and justice equality here, then we need to create our own space where we can realize those mm-hmm. things. And so white nationalism, on the flip side, mm-hmm. they do not want freedom, justice, equality for all people. Mm-hmm. They're hostile to it. And so when we think about the long history of white nationalism from the founding of this country as a white nationalist republic all the way up, and the sort of the fringes now as a sort of struggle over the fate of the United States, I mean, they've always been hostile to the idea of freedom, always hostile to the idea of democracy, and always hostile to the idea of equality as we understand it. So they have notions of freedom, but that freedom itself is based on their ability to do almost with impunity anything with people who they consider unworthy, right? So it's not a sort of idea of a humanistic notion that all people have access to the political apparatus. This idea that white people have access to the political apparatus, and this is the definition of white nationalism, a country for, by, and about white people, constricting citizenship and all the sort of privileges therein to white people. So when I say the United States was at its founding a white nationalist republic, a lot of people, and I find my students and colleagues, very smart people. In fact, people have written, I'm sure, whole books on this kind of stuff, right? That people have argued that, and I have friends that I love and appreciate and are way smarter than I am, who believe that Jews, Poles, Italians, and Irish were not legally white at some point. And I explained to them they've always been legally white. And some people are kind of surprised, but I explained, I said, well, the very first law, federal law to regulate immigration, nationalization, said that only free white people can become US citizens, become American citizens. And in that process, Jews, Poles, Italians, Irish, anyone from Europe became US citizens. They might get called a bad name, but they had access to an all-white army. So when the United States Army, and when the Civil War began, the Civil War at its very beginning was a white man's war explicitly on both sides. Only white people could fight. In fact, when African Americans like Frederick Douglass and a series of other people, there's a guy named Tunis Campbell, who's from New Jersey, who eventually settled in Georgia, becomes part of my book. he was an abolitionist, a black man who volunteered. He was in his early 40s. He volunteered to fight in the Union Army, and he went to an office. And the office in the North said, no, we don't allow white people in here. This is a white man's war. And when people argued that this was going to be an abolitionist war, Lincoln made it very clear. There was a general named John Fremont and he controlled this military district in Missouri. And Fremont, shortly after the war began, in the summer of 1861, Fremont issued his own Emancipation Proclamation for people who were enslaved by Confederates, or Confederate sympathizers, people who were supporting the Confederacy in the military district. Lincoln was incensed, and he told him to rescind that edict. And Fremont was like, no, I'm not going to rescind this edict. He's like, I'm the commander in chief. You do what I say or you'll be fired. And he had to fire Fremont, but he made it very clear. He said, the Negro, in his words, Lincoln, the Negro is no part of this war. And when black soldiers were allowed to fight in the war on the Union side, the Confederates were so incensed that they had to fight, you know, black people. But the idea about the Irish, there were Irish, there were Poles, mm-hmm. there were Italians, there were Jews, all these other people. The fact that there were more of all the foreign-born generals, no country produced more foreign-born generals than Ireland, and there were more Irish generals on the Confederate side. Mm. Also, the second most powerful person in the Confederacy was a guy named Judah Benjamin, who was Jewish. He was an enslaver from Louisiana. He was Secretary of War. He was the second most powerful Confederate. He was on their money. He was a Jewish guy, right? So this idea that the white supremacy did not include, Irish, Jews, Poles, Italians is ahistorical. And there's all this other evidence around it. But the point of this is that at its foundation, the United States was this. And so what I look at, and the Civil War disrupted much of that. The Civil War brought, as you know, you're a historian, the three most important Reconstruction Amendments, mm-hmm. which actually undermined the white nationalist project that had been the United States. Mm-hmm. So the good thing is, for those of us who want to see the United States be a country that lives up to its ideals, the good thing is that after the Civil War, the 13th Amendment said that people could no longer be enslaved. The 14th Amendment said that people who were born in the United States were citizens, which then expanded citizenship beyond just white people. And of course, the 15th Amendment said that all men of age could vote, right? So you had a direct participation in the democratic process. And these things were disruptive. But what's critical about my new study is that throughout the South, Confederates, in their defeat, emerged as neo-Confederates, as redeemers in the antebellum period, in the postbellum period, and did the best they could to reconstruct a white nationalist project where they were. And in Georgia, for example, of course, Black people were purged from polls, just not allowed to vote, not allowed to have access to schools or constricted access to schools, not allowed to be police officers, not allowed to be all sorts of things that were considered essential to citizenship. So there was as much as they were allowed to, within the constrictions of the United States, create an approximation of a white nationalist project. And this would mean that cities like Atlanta, there would be places where there would be parks, mm-hmm. there would be paved roads, electricity and running water, and all the sorts of things that citizens would enjoy that would stop when the Black community began, mm-hmm. right? So you would have paved roads, and the minute that street turned from, Peachtree Street to Alcorn Street on the Black side, the pavement stopped, the electricity stopped, the running water stopped, right? And so there were very clear attempts to recreate, again, a white nationalist project in a virtual sense. And this is what my book explores. And the irony is that in the process of forcing Black people out of the body politic and forcing Black people out of the social, cultural, and political institutions, Black people, as you and I know, created their own. Mm-hmm. In the process of creating their own, in the very acute space of white nationalist expression and neo-Confederate expression in Atlanta, which had emerged as a capital of the New South, you have Black people creating schools, financial, social, economic, political institutions, and then you have this pocket of extraordinary Black success. And this is what I kind of explore, that this extraordinary Black success draws more Black people in, and in an ironic way, more Black people would come to Atlanta and then see Atlanta as this exceptional Black space, and something called Afro self-determinism becomes centerpiece, where Black people enjoy these Black spaces, right? They're like, we have Black schools, we have Black insurance companies, we have Black banks, and Black people they like all these things. They celebrate. Mm-hmm. We can go to whole neighborhoods where there's nothing but Black folks who live in big houses and mm-hmm. pools and tennis courts. And Black people take pride in this sort of thing, right? And it's very different than the intention of the white supremacists who block Black people out. But then Black people have kind of created a space of Black achievement and what we might imagine is Black excellence. And so the history is sort of a history of that.
So I have a couple of questions. So why did you choose Atlanta as the space for your research to explore neo-Confederacy and white nationalism? And then secondly, why do you think Atlanta became this mecca despite the white nationalism?
Excellent questions. And the first one is that this book project really started off looking at the last 50 years of Atlanta's history. But then in order to make context for the rise of Maynard Jackson, I had to go back a little bit. And then to make sense of this, it took me back further. And then before you know it, I was in 1847. Right? I was like, let me just start from the beginning. So the interesting thing is that the Confederacy, when it seceded, they were looking for a capital city. And they said, well, you know, these Americans, this foreign country, their capital is Washington, D.C. We each create our capital. And they had proposals from scores of places. And it came down to three places that were finalists for this. Among the three finalists included Atlanta. It was Richmond, Atlanta, Opelika, Arkansas. And Atlanta was very attractive for a host of reasons, but it didn't make the cut because ultimately they thought if Richmond was the capital, it would guarantee a full-throated commitment from Virginia to the Confederate cause because it had the largest number of military-age white men of any state in the South. So, but during the war, Atlanta became the machinery for the Confederate Army. And the military relied on Atlanta to such an extent that it became, in the words of the governor of Georgia during the Confederacy, when Sherman's troops were headed towards Atlanta, Governor Brown appealed to Jefferson Davis and Richmond. He said, we have to hold Atlanta because Atlanta is to the Confederacy what the heart is to the human body. The Confederacy cannot go on without Atlanta. And so Atlanta had become so critical to the Confederacy. And then it's captured by Sherman in 1864. It really brought the collapse of the Confederacy. Mm-hmm. After that, all across, there were all these wars, successive battles that were lost. And these Confederates were fleeing, and they were collapsing across the country. Lincoln won re-election in November. It was a really big deal. And so Atlanta, after the war, when it reemerged, it was a small city. And many people aren't aware of just how small Atlanta was. So at the beginning of the war, it was number fourth size city in the state of Georgia. So all these other cities were larger. It was not the state capital. In fact, I tell my students there are three times more students at the University of Connecticut than were in the city of Atlanta in 1860. There were under 10,000 people in the city of Atlanta. So Atlanta was a very small place. After the war, there were these great boosters that came in and said, Atlanta is this great place. Let's come in, let's invest. It became the state capital. They started to build things up. And it was a military point as well. But also there was a conspicuous celebration of the Confederacy, even to the extent that they were like a lot of Southern cities, they named all these places after Confederates. They started to, Lee Street, But they also started to build, now, in addition to build monuments, they passed laws, they had a Confederate home, they did, eventually they would have fictional and non-fictional sources that would celebrate Atlanta. Mm-hmm. The most significant, of course, would be Gone with the Wind. Mm-hmm. Then you would have, in addition to novels and movies, like Song of the South, mm-hmm. that would celebrate Atlanta and the Confederacy, there would be these celebrations from the United Daughters of the Confederacy, mm-hmm. and they insisted on creating a big monument to the Confederacy. And this eventually became the largest stone monument mm-hmm. in the world, mm-hmm. and it would draw about 4 to 6 million visitors, Stone Mountain, of course. Mm-hmm. The same guy who designed Stone Mountain did Mount Rushmore, but Stone Mountain is bigger than Mount Rushmore, and all these people came to celebrate people who committed treason against the United States, right? Mm-hmm. These people who literally picked up arms to kill Americans. And you have these people who committed treason against the country mm-hmm. up there as a point of celebration and honor. And Atlanta had become the capital of the New South. But this idea of a New South was a New South that had a very strong through line from the Old South. And in no uncertain terms, the Confederacy was celebrated, it was honored, and it was revered in the New South. And so when we think about the New South and the capital New South, it in no way, in no way disavows its affinity to the Confederate sensibilities of its past.
So how could a Black community flourish in this type of environment? How did Atlanta become the Black Mecca of the United States? I'm really curious about your assessment.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. So one of the things is that we look at how we measure Black success, right? It's a very nebulous set of criteria. Mm-hmm. And it's not the blackest city, actually. So it's not this Atlanta as a city itself is not the highest proportion. In fact, there are probably about 18 cities in terms of cities over 200,000, 250,000. There are probably 18 cities, somewhere thereabouts, my last count, that have a higher percentage of Black people. I mean, you know, Detroit, Baltimore, Memphis. I'm not sure how big Jackson is, but there are a whole bunch of cities that have a higher percentage. There are also cities that have more Black people in raw numbers, right? So, LA probably still, even with all the people fleeing LA, Black people fleeing LA, LA for most of the last 50 years has had significantly more Black people than Atlanta has. And you have, of course, New York and a whole bunch of other places. So Atlanta is not the Blackest by proportion. It's not the Blackest by raw numbers. But most people, if you did any kind of poll and you say, which city in the United States is the Black Mecca? Well, probably 3/4 of people would say Atlanta, right? And then the rest might say D.C.
But D.C.
Second, right? So, and even D.C. would fall in the same category as Atlanta. It's not the Blackest in the other Americas. So the question is, like, what makes it then the Black Mecca? So if you look at the Metro Atlanta, in many ways becomes an abstraction. You have this city with under 500,000 people, but a metro area with 6 million people. Mm-hmm. And so you have this place with somewhere in the vicinity of 13 counties. You have scores of towns, and more Black people over the last 30 years have moved to Metro Atlanta than any metropolitan area in the United States of America, to the point that Metro Atlanta has more Black people than any metropolitan in the United States of America, except New York City. So many Black people moved down to the Atlanta metro area that it's become a critical point to the expression of what we know as Atlanta. And then so So Atlanta also has the highest concentration of Black millionaires, has the highest concentration of Black-owned businesses. Atlanta's city is the second city, is number two among cities that had consecutive Black mayors for over 40 years, each city being the other city. Newark has had a Latino mayor, but in terms of elected mayors, Newark has had all Black mayors as well. So Blacker cities like Gary, Indiana, have actually elected white mayors. Detroit, super Black city, have elected white mayors. Atlanta and DC have exclusively had Black mayors, but also in addition to having Black mayors, the municipal structure of Atlanta is overwhelmingly Black. So disproportionately Black, meaning that Atlanta now is about 54% Black. The people who work in the city, if you ever go to City Hall, you ever been in Fulton County, about 80% of the people who work there are Black people. Right? So the police department, the fire department, city workers are at minimum parity with the Blackness of the city, but often overrepresented. So about 75% of the school teachers, from my last count, were Black. And the city is 54% Black. Few cities in the United States actually claim. I'm in Hartford, for example, where 80% of the city is Black and Latino. We have a white mayor. My child goes to a school that's down the street with a white principal. Most of the school teachers are white. In a city that's 80% of color, you have overwhelmingly sort of white, sort of, and this is anathema to what Atlanta looks like. Like Atlanta actually has that. So the other thing that makes Atlanta exceptional, in addition to having the highest concentration of Black-owned businesses and Black millionaires and disproportionate control, is that if you look at the city government and then you disaggregate the source of jobs from highly skilled white-collar jobs and lower-skilled blue-collar employment in the municipal structure. A lot of cities like Chicago, for example, might be on parity with Black municipal workers. But then you're looking at transportation, you're looking at sanitation, you're looking at these levels where Black people will be higher represented. Then you get to like city managers, the people who are the managers over huge districts, and the attorneys and the managers over finances and things like that, like the percentage of Black people in New York City and a lot of these places, it starts to drop. In Atlanta, Black people are disproportionately represented in the highest echelons of the city government as well, right? So this is, again, very different from other cities across the United States. So city contract, I can go on about that. Atlanta is exceptional. So Mayor Jackson came in with some aggressive affirmative action programs where city contracts go to Black people at higher rates in cities and other places. And finally, the airport. Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport from the 1980s up until the 21st century had been exclusively run by executive leadership of Black people. So you have actually over 30 years of exclusive Black leadership over what become the busiest airport on the planet. And this is unlike anything else. JFK, LAX, De Gaulle, Heathrow, none of these places can say they've had executive Black leadership even for 5 years, let alone for 30 years unbroken, right? And so the busiest airport on the planet to be exclusively run by executive leadership of Black people. Again, so these are all the sort of things about the testimony to what makes Atlanta actually a Black Mecca. And then, actually, I said that was the last thing. I go on and on. More Black people visit Atlanta as a tourist destination than any
I didn't know. That's one fact I didn't know.
Yeah, which is fascinating because Atlanta is not in the body of water. The little Six Flags they have out in Austell, if you're still in Austell, is not a major Six Flags attraction the way that you would find a Disney World or a Disneyland or a Universal Studios in Orlando or somewhere. So it was throughout the 1990s and early 2000s, the largest destination for Black visitors. Keep in mind, you have conventions and Black people love to have you.
Of course, of course, of course.
And even for our academic associations, when the ASALA or National Council for Black Studies has its meeting in Atlanta, we're guaranteed to have a much higher turnout than if we have it in somewhere like Chicago or Los Angeles or New York.
That's true.
So, yeah, exactly. So for Black professionals, beyond the academics, you talk about the National Association of whatever Black people they are, Atlanta was all about more. And you could consider that a lot of these professional associations, in addition to people coming out just to hang out and enjoy Atlanta for just straight leisure. So it is remarkable that we're not by a body of water like Miami. It's not a big giant theme place like Orlando or Vegas or New York. But you do have all these other attractions that draw Black people. I think it is the idea that this is a space for Black excellence, Black achievement, and Black leisure, Black pleasure, that this becomes a site for Black tourists. And so there are all these things that make Atlanta the Black Mecca.
And one thing you left out, which I know you know, is it also has the largest consortium of historically Black colleges and universities. And so we're continually producing graduates that reinforce that idea of excellence within the community, because many graduates end up staying here in Atlanta.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's a huge pool as well. You know, they have very smart, talented workforce of people who are kind of coming in and always refreshing the supply, if you will. Right. Like each year, you have thousands of people coming out, African Americans. I'm not sure how many cities can say that they have each year, thousands of Black people coming out with degrees right in that city. You know, every May, you have thousands of new people coming out with bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, PhDs, and MDs, right? And so you have all these things going on in Atlanta in a way that you just don't find in other places. You know, again, DC has Howard, so it's not. That could be to some extent why Howard and DC also have this sort of energy.
Exactly. Well, I'm excited about this new book project. And what have you decided what the title is going to be yet?
Yeah, it's called Whistling Dixie.
Whistling Dixie. Excuse me. Go ahead with the subtitle. Excuse me.
Yeah, Whistling Dixie. The subtitle has been moved around a little bit, but it's like White Nationalism and How White Nationalism Shaped Atlanta. Maybe How White Nationalism Shaped the Black Mecca, Atlanta, the Black Mecca.
You've been playing with it. You've been playing with it.
Atlanta has to be the title, yeah.
So
and Whistling Dixie actually comes from, I've been trying to do some research on the etymology of that term, and it looks like, so there's a song, Dixie, that existed before the Civil War, but the term Whistling Dixie to mean that, you and I might have a conversation with someone, say, "Oh, what's going on with Charlie? He's wild now." I mean, don't worry about Charlie. He's a Whistling Dixie. Right? He's just talking about something with no real threat. The threat is a hollow threat. Mm-hmm. Like, he's just listening to Dixie. Don't take him seriously. So this idea, when Sherman's army came through Atlanta and defeat and it captured the city, there were these Confederates who were recalcitrant, who were in the on the sidelines as Union soldiers marched down Marietta Street. And as they played a Battle Hymn of the Republic, the sort of Union Army song, or John Brown's Body, again, a Union Army song, these defiant, recalcitrant Confederates, the only thing they could do in their weakness in that moment was to whistle Dixie through their breath. They whistled Dixie to sort of in this defiance. But again, it was a hollow, vacuous, sort of bit of defiance. So in some ways, the city itself is always, at least many white people controlled the city for generations, their elements of the city have always whistled Dixie, right? And so the city always had this homage to old South ways.
Well, I can't wait to read your forthcoming book, and you're welcome to come back here to when you get ready to promote it, and make sure we're one of the spaces you drop by and talk about your book.
I would love to.
So now we come to our college strategies portion of the Empowerment Zone. And Dr. Akbar, can you please tell us what college or colleges did you attend? What were your majors and your degrees? And what is that one strategy you would give students for college success?
So I applied to one school. I always have options. And I went to Morehouse College. I majored when I started my freshman year in sociology, and then I switched over to history probably in my freshman year as well, and decided to become a professor. And once I get a PhD in history, it was the field that most fascinated me, that most captured my interest, but also I did well. And this is a story I really don't tell publicly. I don't know if I have a lot of time here, but back in the day, they would actually post grades on a wall outside the professor's office. You could see your social security number and then your grade. And so Leroy Davis, I don't know if you remember Leroy Davis, but Leroy Davis taught this history class my freshman year.
Yeah, I know.
Uh-huh. Posted the grades. And for the final, I had the highest grade. And I remember just being, and then looking at his other class, he had a whole different section. And then I was like, because of ego, I was like, hey, let me see what anyone else got, like anything higher than whatever I had, 97 or something. I had the highest grade there as well. So for me, it was like, here I am, this dusty, ashy dude from South Central LA, who probably got into more spots than the seat. But this one space I really thrived in was history. Not the one space, but it was a space I particularly thrived in. And to be in there with these really competitive, sharp guys, and to know that I just came to it in a way that was, it was just fulfilling. It was easy for me. Not easy, it was a challenge, but I just thoroughly enjoyed it. That was, I felt my calling to some extent. And then that was my decision. In terms of advice for students in college, I would say to, think about something you're passionate about.
That's
it. Makes the world of a difference to do something that you like. I'll be honest, I didn't think getting a PhD and being a professor would allow me to do things I've enjoyed. Like I've been all around the world. So I've been, in every continent of Australia and Antarctica, but I've also met amazing people. I've done extraordinary things. I've been invited. I've met, Maya Angelou to, Angela Davis and Bobby Seale. And so many people that you just read about in books. Academia has afforded me this really incredible life. But I wasn't thinking, hey, I'm gonna get in here because I'm gonna get a chance to get custom made suits and such, right? Or I'm gonna go hang out with some, Common, have dinner with Common. I didn't think that I would experience the things I did, but it was really my passion in academia that drew me to this, to an extent that my work is not tedious and onerous. It's something onerous. It's something that I enjoy. And it sounds cliche to say, but find something you're passionate about. And when you work, it's actually pleasurable and not onerous. It's not something that you, loathe to experience. And that's something I would say. And I know it could be a challenge because you want to get something that you can be gainfully employed, but I cannot imagine just going for money and thinking that this is going to satisfy my life. That's me personally. And other people might feel differently, but that's my advice.
Great advice. Identify your passion, because your passion is going to be important in terms of fulfillment in your job. You want a job where you'll be fulfilled.
You show up more too. Mm-hmm. I mean, you show up, you commit yourself better. I mean, mm-hmm. you commit yourself in a way that you win for something you mm-hmm. just don't like. Right? Mm-hmm. And so you know, you're more prompt, you're going to be more eager, you'll be mm-hmm. more present. Mm-hmm. And every facet of it is better for you and the people around you when you're passionate mm-hmm. and you like what you do.
Mm-hmm. That's it. That's it. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Jeffrey Ugbar, for that advice.
It's my pleasure.
A special thank you to the incredible team of the Empowerment Zone. Terry Ongully, theme song. NADWORKS, digital support. And of course, our featured guest.
If you enjoyed my podcast, please subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts too. Thank you for your continued support.